So in the UK, we tend to look at a relative definition of poverty, where somebody is poor if they have less than 60% of the income that the person in the middle of the income distribution has, the so-called median person. But we also look at a definition of absolute poverty, where a poverty line is set at a point in time as an absolute standard of living, and then that's kept constant over time, despite what happens to the incomes of other people in the UK. Now, this is set at a relatively high line. It's certainly not anything that's comparable to absolute poverty as you might think of it in a developing country, but it does help to keep track of what's happening to the incomes of those who are relatively poor in the UK. We published a report looking at what's likely to happen to relative and absolute poverty in the UK over the next 10 years. We found that for both children and working age people, that poverty rates are due to increase over the next 10 years, despite the government's introduction of policies like universal credit, which are designed to reduce poverty.
The report from the Institute for Fiscal Studies was really quite alarming. It says there's going to be quite shocking rises in child poverty if the current policies of the government continue without any change. Now, this is a warning. It's not inevitable that this will happen, and this is why we need to see renewed action from the government. We really need them to look again at their child poverty strategy that they published earlier this year, because I think the report shows the strategy is insufficient. The situation at the moment is very difficult for the poorest families and the children in those families. We already have quite high levels of child poverty relative to the rest of Europe, but what we are now seeing with the difficult economic circumstances that we have is stagnating wages. We're seeing prices going up very quickly, particularly for basics like food and fuel. And we're also still seeing job losses, which is hitting some families.
Cut back financially for our family it's been a real struggle. I'm probably taking only, nearly half less than my wages, you know, at the moment, and it's a real struggle. I really struggle at the moment.
Because it's a bit cramped up there with four kids in one bedroom and the baby in the other, so it's a bit difficult sometimes, I know. Right, let's take these in, and then I'll come back for the other one. Oh, he's just been telling me he's saving up for an Iron Man hand. You know, she's always been out and about doing lots of things, so no one was more shocked than myself when she became very ill just after Christmas. In fact, she actually had what we thought was flu around Boxing Day last year. And then by the beginning of January, she was very, very ill. And I now think that was probably the start of what became viral meningitis. My daughter struggled along. Her and her husband struggled along. He had to take unpaid leave because she was really unwell and was going for medical appointments. And I was coming here to look after the children while she was going to appointments and so on. And then she had a fall and was taken into hospital. And he had to have time off. Well, he's not in a job. He's in retail, and he's not in a job where you get carer's leave and you're not particularly protected.
Even going to see June in the hospital, you know, I didn't have the money for petrol, I didn't have the money for car park, you know, so it's, you know, it was a real struggle. I've had to phone her up and say, look, I can't come tonight because I can't afford to get there. So, but it is hard, struggle.
Well, I had viral meningitis in January this year and was rushed into hospital. I finally got over that in March. Then I become very ill in May and started deteriorating, and I've just got worse and worse. I've been to the hospital and everything. They're doing loads of tests on me because they don't exactly know what is actually wrong with me. And my husband had to have his hours cut so that he can help with me being ill. So my husband's lost 9 hours worth of wages, basically. They've cut his hours by 9 hours. I've applied for DLA, which I was informed to apply for. I've only just recently received a letter saying that I'm not entitled to DLA, that I can do certain things that I can't actually do. And it's affected us quite a lot because we're actually on key meters on the gas and the electric, and we're putting in more money because obviously I've got to keep warm as well because I sit here freezing. We've put in more money on the gas, more money on the electric, everything's going up, and it's very, very hard.
Poverty in Britain is relative in the sense that all of my life I've known the principles of having a national health service which gives free health care at the point of use to everybody, and a principle of a welfare state which is meant to protect everyone against the worst aspects of poverty. It was called national assistance, it then became social security. And it's now a series of benefits that are meant to prevent people living in total poverty. It works to the extent that there is very little absolute starvation and absolute poverty in Britain. But it doesn't mean there aren't a lot of people leading very poor lives or a lot of people living in very bad conditions. There are also a series of benefit traps that are brought about by a combination of expensive private rented housing, inadequate jobs, and a very tough regime in gaining access to benefits.
My daughter, who's a genuine case, who is absolutely struggling day to day to live, and her husband as well. And yes, have we claimed? Yes. We claimed for DLA and sort of incapacity, disability and carers support or whatever it is. And we've just received this letter. I'm absolutely gobsmacked. This letter's just come yesterday or the day before to say that my daughter is not entitled to anything. She's not entitled to any care. She's not entitled to anything because of her lack of mobility. I honestly think they've been reading the wrong forms. Her husband is cooking all the meals. He's shopping. He's looking after the children. I'm coming and doing what I can. Her 14-year-old daughter's having to do stuff. You know, it is beyond belief.
It's really hard, and the thing is I can't physically get up and go and do shopping and things like that now, so I have to rely on my husband to go and do the shopping. So I have to sit there and try and work out a list that isn't going to be too much, you know. And we've got to cut back on certain things. I used to get great big bowls of fruit and things like that. Now I used to get like 2 packs of the oranges and things like that because my kids love fruit. Now I've cut it right back to one of each instead. So they've got fruit to go in their lunch boxes and that. And then I have to say to them during the week, well, no, you have to wait till, like, Mummy goes shopping. You know, you can't touch those because at the end of the day, it's for your packed lunch. But it's affected us quite a lot in that sense.
So what we have in this area is unemployment roughly at the national average, child poverty levels well above the national average, and housing conditions well below the national average. And so we have a lot of people on the waiting list to try and get rented accommodation from the council, the local authority, which does its best, but it has a shortage. So most of those people are forced to live in private rented accommodation, which can be very expensive. Recently, a report came out from Shelter, which is a housing charity and campaigning organisation, which said that nobody should pay more than a third of their take-home pay, their income, on rent. There are people around here who pay 2/3 of their income, 70% sometimes, on rent. It's that expensive, and so the poverty comes about from the costs. The government is proposing to cap benefits at a total figure per week, including housing costs. The previous government separated housing costs from benefits, and that will mean destitution for many people in my community. So the poverty is real, the poverty is serious, and I see it.
Housing has a huge part to play in relation to child poverty. And we have very much focused on the impacts on health, on education attainment, and on child welfare that living in bad housing can have. And we very much know that actually, if children aren't given the opportunity to be able to get a good education and the qualifications that they need in order to be able to lift themselves out of poverty, they tend, because of their housing situation, it may prevent them, if they're living in overcrowded conditions, from being able to do their homework or to attend school on a regular basis. What we tend to see is that these children remain in poverty in later life and find it much harder to be able to lift themselves out of it.
Well, I think it's an important moment in Britain at the moment. Obviously, the crisis began in 2008. It shows absolutely no signs of being over yet, and that means there's going to be probably a once-in-a-generation attempt to lower the living standards of working people, to cut their welfare, to cut their wages, to dispense with their jobs, and to make them pay for a crisis which created in the banking industry for which they had absolutely no responsibility. And it seems to me that that's an essential moment when people in the trade union movement, in campaigning movements, people who want to see a more equal and just society, have to step forward and try and do something about the fact that the very richest people in the society are trying to make some of the poorest people in the society pay for a crisis that they didn't create. Welfare, by definition, and especially after 20 years where welfare provision has been cut back rather than expanded, welfare provision, by definition, is for the most needy, the poorest, the most desperate sections of the population. And after 20 years of cuts, there's not a lot of fat on the bone, despite what the millionaires in the current government tell us. So what this is going to do is it's going to hit the very poorest, the very neediest, hardest. People who are long-term sick or disabled are going to be hit more than the average. Women who are thrown out of employment, or actually women's unemployment is now rising faster than the average, they will be hit hardest. Ethnic minorities who disproportionately depend on welfare services will be hit hardest. The already poorest families, single parent families, the poorest children will be hit hardest. So the cutting of welfare is over and above the general strategy of trying to shift the burden of the crisis onto working people. Is in addition to that, it's an attempt to shift the burden onto the very poorest sections among working people, and therefore is a particularly vicious and unjustified government policy.
I think children will be amongst the first to suffer from the economic crisis that we're in, and partly for a whole number of reasons, partly because of unemployment, which impacts badly on children, partly because of cuts to welfare, cuts to social service provision, which means that we are already seeing an alarming growth of child poverty. And this is something which in the 21st century, in a so-called advanced country, you would have thought would have been eradicated. But unfortunately, this is not the case. And there are large areas of the more impoverished, the more badly affected areas by the recession and by the cuts, where life for many, many young people is becoming, and many, many kids, is becoming an absolute nightmare due to serious levels of poverty, which is just, it's just shocking in today's Britain. And so it's a kind of, it's a man-made situation. And very often, some of the experts and the media try to present it as something almost an inevitable product of natural causes. But I think it's far from that. I think it's a product particularly of the last 20 or 30 years of neoliberal economics, which has dominated the world stage and which has created huge profits for a tiny minority of people and therefore a massive inequality. And those at the bottom of society have, both in every country around the world, but also in the less developed countries, the countries that suffer from low levels of investment, that suffer from debt, that suffer from often actually military attack by the West, those countries have suffered disproportionately. So for me, child poverty and poverty in general in the 21st century is a crime.
The there's about 2.8 million children, according to the most recent figures, that are suffering from what's termed child poverty across the UK. And we know that, in common with all kinds of poverty, this has a huge impact on people's lives. People who are suffering from financial need have all kinds of different problems, and it does directly impact on mental health, on physical health, and on their ability to get jobs and to interact with their friends and their family as well. And that is writ large with children who are suffering from poverty and from financial need as well.
Poverty in the 21st century in this country means, for children, it means their parents not being able to provide them with the real basic material necessities. And we're talking about parents not being able to afford to keep the house warm during the winter time, them not being able to afford enough nutritious food for their families. And we know that there is a big connection between children growing up in poverty and not doing very well at school, and therefore not going on to fulfil their lives, and having much greater chance of themselves being adults in poverty and their own children being in poverty. That's why it's essential that the government and society really takes a grip of the problem and tackles child poverty in Britain.
One of the things we found very surprising when we're looking at the report is the sheer scale in the reduction of incomes that we're forecasting to happen over the period from 2009 to 2012. The impact of the recession that's hit the UK economy hasn't really been translated across into reductions in household incomes as yet in the data that we've seen, but really that's just pain that's been delayed from the recession that we've just seen and the big reduction in the productive capacity of the UK economy. And that pain is due to hit households over the next few years.
In the last 10 years, although we've seen improvements in child poverty, one feature has been that the proportion of children in poverty who actually come from households with work has increased within the overall figure for children in poverty. I think that shows that while we made a lot of progress in the last decade for getting more households into work, that we weren't thinking enough about the quality of those jobs and the level of wages needed. It's really quite a dramatic figure to think about that if you go back a few decades, wages as a proportion of the whole economy were 65%. Today it's only 53%. So tackling the unfairness of wages for those at the bottom is a major thing. But we also have some quite entrenched problems that you still see very high levels of child poverty for lone parent families, for many minority ethnic groups, and also for families affected by disability.
The effect it's had is that she's got no way of actually driving the children around. They can't afford to have the car on the road all the time. They can't afford to. She can't actually get here or there. So she's got reliant on people. I've been doing shopping and helping with cleaning and cooking and helping the children. And it's been very, very difficult. She's fallen in the kitchen when her children were here and they've had to pick her up. And that was very difficult because they couldn't do it. They've had to ring their dad at work. I mean, this is a disgraceful decision. And I think it's going to get worse. I think there are people being told, don't allow this. You know, as part of the government cuts, they're cutting the people who are doing these. So it takes from sort of 6 weeks to 6 months to get a decision anyway, or 16 weeks, about 4 months to get a decision anyway on DLA stuff. And I think the average is about 13 weeks for a decision. This has probably been nearly that. Nearly 2 months. And you end up with a situation where they're not allowing it anyway. I think in the next year, we are going to see massive child poverty. We will see children dying because they're cold or because their families are having to choose whether to heat their homes or to eat. And I think this government is a disgrace that they are going to see children dying in this country because they can't be fed and looked after. They can't even be clothed. I mean, just to get a reasonable pair of shoes, you're paying £15-20. You know, even if you go to the market, stuff is really expensive, just basic things. The government wants us not to be obese, but if you're having to live on bread and jam sandwiches, like we did when we were younger. I was from a poor family and I remember having bread and jam sandwiches and stuff. And that's what's happening now. Kids are having to live off of very cheap fill you up foods which are not ever so nutritious. We can't afford the sorts of stuff that David Cameron does. We struggle, and they wouldn't do it. I would say to David Cameron, you do it. And if you didn't pay so much out on war and all the stuff in Libya, you know, absolute disgrace that we are paying out billions of pounds of our money on wars in countries where we shouldn't have even gone. We shouldn't be interfering. It's an absolute disgrace.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz.
In the limelight.
Everybody is ignoring the deeper structural reason for price increases. The concentration of the American economy into the hands of a few corporate giants with the power to raise prices, says Robert Reich Ryder in an article published under the heading, "The U.S. Underlying Problem Isn't Inflation, It's Corporate Power and Greed." Stay tuned for more. Inflation. Everybody is talking about it in the U.S., but ignoring one of its biggest causes, corporate concentration. Now prices are undeniably rising. In response, the Fed is about to slow the economy, even though there are still 2 million jobs short of where they were before the pandemic, and millions of American workers won't get the raises they deserve. Meanwhile, Republicans haven't wasted any time hammering Biden and Democratic lawmakers about inflation. Don't fall for their fear-mongering. Everybody is ignoring the deeper structural reason for price increases. The concentration of the American economy into the hands of a few corporate giants with the power to raise prices. If the market were actually competitive, corporations would keep their prices as low as possible as they competed for customers. Even if some of their costs increased, they would do everything they could to avoid passing them to customers in the form of higher prices for fear of losing business to competitors. But that's the opposite of what we're seeing. Corporations are raising prices even if they take in record profits. Corporate profits margins hit record highs last year. You see, these corporations have so much market power, they can raise prices with impunity. So the underlying problem isn't inflation per se. It's a lack of competition. Corporations are using the excuse of inflation to raise prices and make fatter profits. Take the energy sector. Only a few entities have access to the land and pipelines that control the oil and gas powering most of the world. They took a hit during the pandemic, as most people stayed home. But they are more than making up for it now, limiting supply and ratcheting up prices. Or look at consumer goods. In April 2021, Procter & Gamble raised prices on staples like diapers and toilet paper, citing increased costs in raw material and transportation. But P&G has been making huge profits. After some of its price increases went into effect, it reported an almost 25% profit margin. Looking to buy the people's diapers elsewhere? Good luck. The market is dominated by P&G and Kimberly-Clark, which not entirely coincidentally raised its prices at the same time. Another example, in April 2021, PepsiCo raised prices, blaming higher costs for ingredients, freight, and labor. It then recorded $3 billion in operating profits through September. How did it get away with this without losing customers? Pepsi has only one major competitor, Coca-Cola, which promptly raised its own prices. Coca-Cola recorded $10 billion in revenues in the third quarter of 2021, up 16% from the previous year. Food prices are soaring, but half of that is from meat, which cost 15% more than last year. There are only four major meat processing companies in America, which are all raising their prices and enjoying record profits. The U.S. underlying problem is not inflation, it's corporate power. Since the 1980s, when the U.S. government all but abandoned antitrust enforcement, two-thirds of all American industries have become more concentrated. Most are now dominated by a handful of corporations that coordinate prices and production. This is true of banks, broadband, pharmaceutical companies, airlines, meat packers, and yes, soda. Corporations in all these industries could easily absorb higher costs, including long overdue wage increases, without passing them on to customers in the form of higher prices. But they aren't. Instead, they're using their massive profits to line the pockets of major investors and executives, while both consumers and workers get shafted. How can this structural problem be fixed? Fighting corporate concentration with more aggressive antitrust enforcement and imposing a windfall profits tax on profitable corporations that are using this period of rising costs to gouge consumers. So don't fall for the fear-mongering about inflation. The real culprit here is corporate power.
Tuman. Yani?
Bazaar.
Considered to be the biggest sector in the world in terms of dollar value, The oil and gas sector is a global powerhouse. It uses hundreds of thousands of workers worldwide and generates hundreds of billions of dollars globally each year. The largest volume of products coming out of the oil and gas industry are fuel oil and gasoline. Oil has been used as fuel for transport to generate electricity that lights homes and run factories and machines. And petroleum is the primary material for numerous chemical products, including pharmaceuticals, fertilizers, solvents, and of course, plastics. Our lives would be very different without oil.
Hello once again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes industries, markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This time we're going to explore technology and engineering related to the oil and gas industry. We wanted to see who the major players in this field are and why their services are so complex and unique. So let's start the show. Our journey took us to a knowledge-based engineering company called Farazan Saze Darya, which began its work over a decade ago. Its main activity is to design and build structures related to oil and gas extraction and transfer. It has a broad scope of engineering services. The things it designs encompass onshore and offshore oil platforms, storage tankers, distribution pipelines, and other structures and buildings related to the oil and gas industry. Just like the structure or facility, oil infrastructure is also susceptible to earthquake damage, particularly in southern Iran, where tremors are more common. This firm was among the first engineering companies to implement the new government standards for earthquake-proofing oil platforms and rigs both in and off land. This company has a long portfolio of projects it has engineered over the years. One such project was to create oil tankers and pumps for the strategic Jask oil project. This is a project that transfers oil through a 1,000-kilometer pipeline along the southern coast to the Jask oil terminal. It is predicted that after completion, this project will have the capacity to transfer up to 1 million barrels of crude per day. However, that's only one of the projects that this company has completed, and there are dozens more. Previously, such services were imported into the country. This means that when a new oil platform was needed or an old one needed maintenance, industry participants had to employ foreign companies to come to Iran and get the job done. Among other complications, this process was expensive and created a dependency on foreign services. One of the major advantages of this company is it has localized this specialized engineering service in the country. Indigenizing and employing domestic know-how in the oil industry has helped the country save millions over the years. This company has developed such that now it exports its engineering services. It also collaborates with foreign firms to build and design structures. This firm has created hundreds of employment opportunities, particularly in specialized field of engineering in the gas and oil sector. It has also indirectly generated numerous jobs through subcontractors and construction execution. It is no surprise that this knowledge-based firm has gathered some of the most experienced experts in the industry at its facilities. Among its many activities, it also cooperates with numerous universities and academic institutions. Such steps are necessary for this company to stay up to date. Plus, it incorporates and applies cutting-edge technology in the design and implementation of its projects. This company adheres to strict international standards for designing and building its structures. With years of experience and numerous foreign contracts under its belt, this company has been able to expand its know-how for executing projects with the highest quality.
here's a fun fact you might not have known. With rich oil reserves, Iran is one of the founding members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, also known as OPEC. Based on figures from OPEC, the country is the fourth largest oil producer among its members. Plus, Iran possesses the third largest oil reserves in the world.
Iran's oil sector will be the first to benefit from the removal of sanctions. Foreign companies remain interested in this market as they anticipate its largest potential. But the road to Iran's market has been obstructed by U.S.-imposed sanctions. Based on figures from OPEC, nearly 80% of the world's proven oil reserves belong to member countries. The majority of these reserves are located in West Asia, amounting to some 64% of the OPEC total. Iran has over 156 billion barrels of proven oil reserves as of 2019, which is roughly 9% of the world's share. Going off of OPEC statistics, Iran produced nearly 3,000 barrels of oil per day on June 2021. Production figures would be much higher if it were not for sanctions imposed on Iran by Washington. Iran's oil industry has faced heavy sanctions since former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. According to the Ministry of Oil, the average daily production of oil before the reimposed sanctions was over 3 million barrels per day. The government has plans to surpass the pre-sanctions production levels to over 4 billion barrels per day. That's, of course, under the stipulation that the sanctions against oil companies and exports are removed.
As you might know, Iran's oil industry is a major engine behind the country's economic growth. Oil exports generate millions in foreign revenue, but the country also uses this valuable resource in other industries to make various products. Petroleum and petrochemical products, such as plastics, are also derived from oil and natural gas, and Iran makes a large amount of both.
Figures from the Iranian National Plastic and Polymer Industrial Association show that Iran can potentially export $5 billion worth of petchem products. Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced every year. Another derivative of crude oil is gasoline, and Iran completely supplies its domestic needs with its daily productions. In the past year, due to reduced internal usage, much of the surplus was exported to international markets. Based on the National Iranian Oil Products Distribution Company, last year nearly 700,000 barrels of gasoline fuel were produced each day. Data from this company shows that Iran has managed to boost its gasoline exports despite sanctions. Over $1 billion worth of gasoline was exported in the first half of last year alone. That's higher than the year 2020, when Iran exported nearly $500 million worth of this commodity. Everyone knows technological innovation is reshaping the world faster than ever before. From the smartphone revolution to self-driven cars, technology has had an impact on our lives in almost every way. On a broader scale, technology has changed major sectors over the past 20 years, including healthcare, telecommunication, energy, and so much more. And knowledge-based products in particular have increased safety, speed, and efficiency in manufacturing sectors. In many ways, technology has the power to do many things, and changing the world is one of them.
In this show, we will take a look at how technology is developing Iranian industries. We wanted to uncover how indigenizing its products has contributed to industrial expansion, particularly helping oil and gas industry thrive. Plus, we will talk about what the government is doing to support the development of high tech used in industries. So let's go check it out.
We made a stop at Ara Tajhis System Consulting Engineers in the capital city of Tehran. This company has been around for years and makes a range of electronics and devices that deal with electricity. Among its products, this company makes air conditioners and purification systems in a variety of styles. But that's not all. This company is mostly known for its production of UPS systems, industrial and non-industrial chargers and inverters. Now, you might be wondering what a UPS system is and what it does. These are devices used when the electricity goes out. Broadly speaking, a UPS uses a battery to create an uninterruptible power supply to whatever electronics need it. For example, think of your laptop. UPS acts a lot like your laptop battery when the power cord is disconnected. This allows a stream of power for a certain amount of time until the power source can be reconnected again. So you can save your work when the power goes out or until the generator kicks in. Most large and small businesses use UPS systems. This is because, in addition to offering a plan B during power outages, they are designed to be smart enough to regulate power surges, sags, line noise, and whatever else disrupts electricity. There are other types of UPSs too, and some of them can protect devices. Urban electricity is not always consistently supplied. This means the city's electricity may carry a lot of noise and fluctuations. So for those who live in areas with multiple power outages and possess expensive electronic equipment, this type of UPS helps protect them from irreversible damages. But it's not just home appliances or office equipment that benefit from these items. Large establishments such as hospitals are required to have these systems too. UPS devices are vital in clinics and healthcare facilities as power outages can be fatal. Typically, they are equipped with several UPS systems that are used in surgery theaters, imaging departments, intensive care units, and so much more. This company has supplied UPS systems and inverters to dozens of hospitals in the capital as well as numerous other hospitals across the country. It has two manufacturing facilities located in industrial towns. One of its production units has an area of 3,000 square meters with a massive warehouse to store its products. Quality is paramount here. And this company prides itself in making products that are dependable with a zero failure rate by following national and international safety and quality production guidelines. As part of its future vision, this knowledge-based manufacturer is planning on expanding its product portfolio. It also wants to increase its export reach. Among its staff, it employs experienced engineers and researchers at its R&D department. This is the beating heart of the company, and it's home to the quality control unit as well. This company has overcome many challenges over the years to be able to appreciate its achievements. One such hurdle has been the U.S.-imposed economic sanctions. We tend to take electricity for granted until the light goes out. For most of us, we just endure until the power comes back on. But for refineries, there are more serious consequences when the power is lost. In general, power disruptions in refineries happen more frequently than you might think. And when they do, there are mitigation technologies available for minimizing unplanned shutdowns. Power cuts can be extremely costly to a refinery. It can damage machines and equipment, not to mention that a shutdown also means less daily production and slashing profits. The company we mentioned earlier in the program is one of several knowledge-based firms in the country that provide advanced industrial-grade technologies to refineries. Previously, this technology was imported, but now it's domestically manufactured. However, this is only one example of technology that has been indigenized to further develop the gas and oil sectors. Unlike many other industries, the hydrocarbon sector has been slow to adopt technological innovations. It is partly because this sector has done so well that perhaps the drive to improve and innovate simply wasn't there. This changed after reimposing the US-led sanctions on Iran. Iran's refineries are long overdue for a technological upgrade. Luckily, for companies in the fossil fuel industry, there are lots of opportunities popping up for them to revamp operations and propel them into the modern-day playing field. For example, some companies have incorporated innovations in robotics to help get the job done. An integral part of the drilling process in oil extraction is connecting and disconnecting drill pipes. Previously, the process of connecting and disconnecting drill pipes was extremely dangerous for those who did it. Consequently, robotics has made a lot of boring and dangerous elements of drilling safer. The Iranian oil and gas sector has been taking off at a rapid pace. That's all despite external challenges like the coronavirus pandemic and the U.S. sanctions. The country is passing new milestones in this industry every day. Meanwhile, the government has implemented several policies and initiatives to support technological development for this industry. The oil industry is an area with outstanding performance over the years, and many measures have led to high levels of self-reliance in all parts of this sector so far. Much of the success is attributed to the hard work of knowledge-based companies in developing technologies to sustain the industry. The capabilities of knowledge-based companies play a significant role in keeping the industry current with the times. The oil ministry says these companies are helping enhance the production of 700 oil and gas wells in the country. Figures from the ministry show Iran has more than 5,500 oil and gas wells in 400 fields nationwide. The ministry plans to use the power of research and knowledge-based companies to increase annual production with the least capital and risk. The goal is to turn existing sources, namely raw material, into wealth. So, for this to happen, the industry must start using science and technology. All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear colleague and friend out on the field who has prepared an interesting feature program for you. Let's go check it out.
Northern Iran consists of the southern border of the Caspian Sea and the Alborz Mountains. It includes three major provinces, Gilan, Mazandaran, and Golestan. This region enjoys annual precipitation ranging from 600 millimeters to 2,000 millimeters. The lush-green Caspian region is home to 80 species of tree and 50 species of shrubs. Every year, Iran exports more than 2,300 tons of flowers and plants to 23 countries. The Islamic Republic annually exports some $15 to $20 million of its flora and plants. And today, we are in Mazandaran province to visit a company that produces ornamental trees and flowers. Cultivation of various ornamental plants due to the favorable climate of Iran and the income from their exports can play a significant role in development of Iran's national production. Iran is one of the only countries in the world which is the complete four seasons, which has made it possible to produce most flowers in the country. If this indigenous capacity of Iran is at rest, not only can Iran fulfill domestic needs, but also it can have a stronger presence in the global market. Plans to transfer to Nashtarud in western Mazandaran province next month. Nashtarud is a perfect place for planting ornamental flowers and plants and could turn into the center of ornamental flowers and plants production in Iran.
For
For our final portion of the program, let's dive right into it and take a brief look at some news and trends in Iran's oil and gas industries. Industry participants say Iran is nearly self-sufficient in the field of producing technology necessary for the oil and gas sector. Now, an Iranian company is set to commercialize a multi-phase pump used in the oil industry. The Iran-made pumps will be used to transport oil and gas on fields. These multi-phase pumps are becoming popular among operators around the world as a tool for more economical and environmentally friendly oil and gas transport. The idea is to flow and pressure boost the raw well stream before the processes of separation and treatment of the product. With the help of Iranian engineers, another area that the country has reached full self-reliance is maintenance and repairs of offshore oil platforms. In the past, platforms were sent to other countries for repairs. Now, it's done domestically and has saved the country roughly $6 million for each rig. There are tens of drilling rigs of the Persian Gulf and Sea of Oman, which has been built and installed by domestic knowledge-based companies. Drilling equipment has also been indigenized. Seismic exploration studies carried out in the Caspian Sea region have led to key discoveries, adding to Iran's proven oil and natural gas reserves. Results of the study showed the likely presence of a massive hydrocarbon formation in Iran's northern Gorgan Plain. The exploration included drilling 20 wells in the region near the border of Turkmenistan in Golestan province near the Caspian Sea. Preliminary findings detected that the gas field holds some 3 trillion cubic meters of natural gas, making it the world's 10th largest gas reservoir. Well, that covers our program for today. Plus, you can get in touch with us with your thoughts and comments through our email. I'll see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
2 doses of COVID vaccine cut the risk of infection and mild illness from the rising BA2 subvariant, although protection wanes quickly, says Saimam A. Sadiq Ryder in an article published under the heading Vaccines protect against infection from Omicron subvariant, but not for long. Stay tuned for more. The Omicron subvariant, BA2, is replacing its sister version, BA1, as the dominant form of SARS-CoV-2 in many countries, which has led scientists to wonder whether the COVID-19 pandemic is about to throw these regions into disarray yet again. But a study published on March 13th shows that mRNA vaccines offer a similar degree of protection against the two strains, although protection against SARS-CoV-2 infection and symptomatic disease wanes within months of a third dose. The study published on the preprint server MedRvex has not yet been peer-reviewed. Researchers have known for months that the BA1 subvariant evades much of the protection that mRNA vaccines offer against mild to moderate disease. Scientists quickly realized that BA2 spreads more rapidly than BA1, but it wasn't immediately clear whether the newcomer would also prove to be more adept at evading vaccines. BA2 could be even worse than BA1. This was the fear, says Leit Abu Raad, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Weill Cornell Medicine Qatar in Doha and co-author of the study. Abu Raad and his colleagues performed a massive observational study using vaccination records and SARS-CoV-2 test results from Qatar's healthcare system. They found that Qatari residents who received two doses of vaccines enjoyed several months of substantial protection against symptomatic disease caused by either BA1 or BA2. But protection waned to around 10% after only 4 to 6 months, meaning that the vaccines prevented only 10% of the cases that would have occurred if all the individuals had been unvaccinated. Protection against BA2 did not seem to wane any faster than protection against BA1, and a booster shot brought the protection against symptomatic infection by either subvariant back to 30 to 60%. Surveillance data collected in the UK reveal a similar trend. Vaccine effectiveness against symptomatic COVID-19 is less than 20% for both subvariants 25 weeks or more after a second dose, but rises to roughly 70% 2 to 4 weeks after a third dose. The researchers also analyzed the degree of protection that mRNA vaccines offer against severe disease, but to do so, they had to pool the data on BA1 and BA2 cases, a measure that was necessary because Qatar's population is strongly skewed towards young people, making severe COVID-19 cases rare. Only after polling did the researchers have enough cases to achieve meaningful results. This analysis showed that protection against severe disease remained at 68% or higher for at least 7 months, even in people who had only received two vaccine doses, and shot up to over 80% after a booster dose. Abu Raad says that because 70 to 80% of the pooled cases were BA2, he suspects that vaccines still offer a high level of protection against severe disease in the face of surging BA2 levels. In an email to Nature, virologist Andrew Pekas at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, wrote that overall, the work is a very sound study. Qatar has been at the lead when it comes to reporting data on COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness in a very rapid manner. Abu Raad says the results give him hope because